Hey teachers, this episode is sponsored by Spaces Digital Portfolios. Spaces makes student growth in your classroom come to life with their free visual portfolio tool. Teachers can create spaces for their entire classroom, student groups, or for individual students, all online and completely free. Celebrate student learning and give parents a window into your classroom. Try Spaces at www.spacesedu.com today.
Is this the teacher hotline?
Hello, everyone. I hope everyone is doing well. I'm your host, Ronald Hay, and welcome back to the Teacher Hotline, where we try to answer some of the most pressing questions for teachers in and outside of the classroom. Today, our caller comes from Barbour from the Thames Valley District School Board. Barbour, what can we do for you today?
Hey, Ron. I'm a 34-year-old teacher who's been teaching for 7 years. I love your financial literacy episodes for teachers so far. Since you're a business teacher, love to get your take on how to best construct a financial portfolio. With where the economy is currently at and where things are headed, what's your thoughts on the best asset allocation? Bond yields are at all-time lows, but the stock market seems overpriced. I also keep hearing about another stock market crash. If you have time on the segment, love to hear your thoughts on more riskier investments like cryptocurrencies and cannabis stock.
Thank you, Barbour, for calling in. I am so happy to hear you ask that question, because the silver lining of the pandemic has definitely been the fact that it has attracted a lot more retail investors like yourself. People recognize this is a great time to invest and want to learn more about this subject, and we're happy to help. So today I brought in the best in the business. Today it's my pleasure in getting to speak with Andrew Hallam, a personal finance journalist, public speaker, and international best-selling author. Andrew is the author of some of the best personal finance books that includes Millionaire Teacher, Millionaire Expat, How to Build Wealth Living Overseas, and the 9 Rules of Wealth You Should Have Learned in School. Starting off as a high school English teacher, Andrew married his passion for books and finance together and began writing books on investing, which has allowed him to be profiled on such media as CNBC, The Wall Street Journal. He's also been the first person to have a number one selling finance book on Amazon USA, Amazon Canada, and Amazon UAE. He has written columns for the Globe and Mail, Canadian Business, Money Sense, Internax, and Asset Builder. And since 2016, he's spoken at businesses and international schools in over 30 different countries. And today we have a pleasure of having him here on the Teacher Hotline. Andrew, what an absolute pleasure of having you on. Thank you for joining us today.
Hey, it's my pleasure. Thanks for the invitation.
So Andrew, this episode is really for teachers out there that are ready to invest or perhaps have already invested but are looking to learn just a little bit more. So if you're tuning into this episode for the first time and you're still uncomfortable with some of the terminology or unsure which brokerage account to open with, I encourage you to go back to episode number 2 or 5 to give you some background knowledge. So Andrew, we got so much to talk about today, so why don't we jump straight into things? So for teachers who have not read your book yet, you are a big advocate for index investing. So what exactly is index investing, and why index investing versus picking individual stocks?
Index investing is essentially owning a portfolio whereby there's a representation of the entire global market within it. So if you have a globally diversified portfolio of index funds, you literally own a sliver of virtually every company in the world, or at least a broad representation of those companies. So Chinese companies, American companies, Canadian companies. You own an entire global basket, and nobody actually trades those stocks internally. So nobody is saying, hey, we're going to go heavier on ExxonMobil because we think oil is going to do better than technology this quarter. So we're going to sell a little bit of Apple, load up on a little bit of ExxonMobil. Oh, we think China is going to do better than the United States. So let's move a little bit over to China. That's called active management. a portfolio of index funds doesn't have any of that. It just comprises stocks from around the world, if it's globally diversified, and nobody does any internal trading. Now, here's the really cool thing about it. It doesn't sound, first of all, in the outset, very sophisticated, but a globally diversified portfolio of index funds is incredibly cheap, in part as a result of it being so cheap in terms of the way it's actually managed, because there's no active trading that takes place. It outperforms most hedge funds. It outperforms most college endowment funds. It outperforms most tactical asset allocation funds. In fact, it will outperform on what we call an equal risk adjusted basis at least 90% of professional traders. So this isn't me just saying this. This is an academical, irrefutable truth. It's like gravity. And of course, there's a whole bunch of people saying, well, if it outperforms 90% of them, I want to be in the top 10%. Everybody's chasing that top 10%. But the unfortunate part is that even when you find a fund or a fund manager or a professional stock picker who ends up in that top 10% and beats a globally diversified portfolio of index funds, typically there's something called reversion to the mean. So if they beat that performance over a one-time period, they usually and then go on to underperform it during the following time period. So investing is incredibly simple. And I think that's what I want to get across to everybody who's listening. Fidelity did a study. They wanted to see what its best investors, who are our best investors. And so if you're listening to this right now, you're probably thinking, I don't have time to follow the stock market. I don't have time to try and pick hot stocks. I don't have the expertise, or I just don't have the knowledge, no idea what to do. The funniest part about this, Ronald, is that when Fidelity did a study to see who its best investors were, so Fidelity is a giant mutual fund company, and they wanted to see, well, how old were they? What was their demographic? What was their professional background? Did they have master's degrees in economics? The truth is it was none of that. Do you know what it was? There were two categories that they fell into, the best investors that Fidelity ended up tracking. Ronald, do you know what they are?
What are they? I'd love to know.
I'm curious to see if you knew. Okay. Number one, they were dead people. And they were people who had forgotten they even had accounts with Fidelity. So they were people that obviously had put together some kind of, or somebody had put together a diversified basket of mutual funds, and they just simply left them alone. Investing is like a bar of soap. The more you mess with that bar of soap, the smaller it gets. So what I can promise you is this. I can't promise you how much money you're going to make in the stock market in terms of percentages over this year, over next year, over the next 10 years. I have no clue. But I can guarantee this as a mathematical certainty, that if you build a portfolio of index funds, a globally diversified one, and you just add money to it, and you don't try to time the market, you don't try to figure out the best time to buy and the best time to sell, you just add money whenever you have it. So it might be on a monthly basis, you're just dripping money in on a monthly basis, you will outperform 90% of investment professionals over your lifetime. So it's really that simple. So many people have a hard time accepting it.
So you make a very compelling case for index funds. Why do you think that so many teachers and just any investors in general, they're so attracted to buying individual stocks out the gate? Do you think it's just kind of more that they're unequipped with the knowledge, or do you think there's something attractive of buying individual stocks?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't know that most teachers like to buy individual stocks. I thought most of the people that I've bumped into end up buying mutual funds rather than individual stocks. So I think too, Ronald, your circle, you're probably connected with a circle of people that buy individual stocks. And so they talk about it. So that happens to be your friend group, but most people don't. It's not that common. It's not as common as buying actively managed mutual funds from the banks. I think what people do is they find, of course, buying individual stocks is exciting. And people will presume that they know something that others don't, that they have some kind of edge, some kind of skill. But of course, the statistical data on this is that over your lifetime, if you're picking your own individual stocks, your odds of beating the investment professionals are incredibly slim. The odds of you beating the investment professionals with a portfolio of index funds are incredibly high. So if you're basing it on pure statistics, it's far better to save your time, build a portfolio of index funds, and long-term, over your lifetime, you'll almost be guaranteed to make more money.
So I want to go back to your book again, Millionaire Teacher, because there is a segment of the book that you talk about index investing and ETFs. And you explain that there is a slight difference, but they're very close to being the same thing. And I know a lot of times people kind of use those two words very interchangeably. So before we kind of dive into more deeper topics, maybe if we could just set the stage for what are those differences between ETFs versus index investing?
They're really similar. And I do use them interchangeably all the time. I think of it as like, bananas. And let's say you have two ways of buying bananas. You can buy bananas from the supermarket, or let's just say you could buy bananas via Amazon. I don't know why anybody would.
That's how I buy my bananas all the time, Andrew.
Of course, and they end up all smushed and brown and, broken.
That's the way I love my bananas, Andrew.
Well, they're the best in a smoothie that way, Ronald. That's why I highly recommend it. I'm glad that you do that. You're still buying bananas, but you're just buying them a different way. And it's the same with an index fund and an ETF. With an index fund, technically speaking, you would buy them from a fund company. So the first index fund was created by a firm called Vanguard. And Vanguard's the world's largest index fund provider. And in the US, they make it so convenient to invest with Vanguard. I mean, you open up an account, a certain amount of money, you can have it wired automatically from your savings account directly into your, let's say it's this S&P 500 index or a global stock market index. It just gets wired into there and you're buying it directly from the fund company. Vanguard didn't actually present itself to Canadians that way. And so there was really no competition for low cost indexed mutual funds. And so our banks started to offer them. Our banks got kind of wise to the idea and said, geez, you know what? All these books about how index funds beat the typical actively managed funds that we offer. So let's offer indexed mutual funds. But instead of doing what Vanguard does, Vanguard's essentially, it's run much like a nonprofit. It's a co-op, really. The people who invest in those funds actually kind of own the company, technically. But our banks went, wow, all these books about index funds and how they beat actively managed products, let's create index mutual funds, but instead of doing what Vanguard does and charging people 0.01% per year, let's charge people like 1.1% and see what happens. Well, people did go into the banks and ask for them, and they did buy them. And the interesting thing is I did a series, Ronald, in the Globe and Mail on this, and I said, all right, the index mutual funds you buy in Canada are expensive. You really shouldn't be buying them. But hey, let's put them toe-to-toe with the actively managed funds that are sold by those same institutions. And so I did a whole series for the Globe and Mail on this, where I would take the Royal Bank of Canada's actively managed funds and I would compare them to the Royal Bank of Canada's index funds, which were overpriced. But on aggregate, their index funds in every category beat their actively managed products when we averaged out how their active managed products did in each category. So index mutual funds in Canada tend to be expensive. And so we don't really need to buy them. The cheapest are the TDE series products, which are good. They're relatively cheap, but man alive, are they ever hard to buy. You walk into TD Bank and you try and actually say, hey, look, I want you to build me a portfolio. They'll put their arm around you, take you to the corner, and they'll try to convince you to buy something else. So you need a self-directed account to actually be able to buy those relatively low-cost E-series index funds. And so for that reason, the ETF model is so much easier. So an ETF, much like an index fund, it trades, in this case, though, it trades on a stock market, on a stock exchange. And so people could literally buy an ETF at 9 o'clock and sell it 1 minute later at the change in price between, say, 9 o'clock and 9:01. I would never recommend that, but it trades like a stock. But long term, if let's say we have a Canadian stock market index and a Canadian stock market ETF, if their fee were the same and they track the exact same market, they would earn about the same return, minus a tiny difference in tracking error depending on the year. So again, like buying bananas from either Amazon or the supermarket.
I remember buying index mutual funds from the bank probably once I started investing. And I will say this, not to say that I'm a big advocate for index mutual funds from banks, but I will say the one pro that they have going for them is the ease of access to buying it. Whereas like an ETF, whatever, you got to actually open up the account, which I actually, from what I understand from talking to people, again, this is very little research. It's just even opening an account sometimes could be a big barrier for people. Whereas going into a bank and say, hey, I want XYZ is a little bit easier to buy, which is how it allowed me to kind of start investing until I realized, to your point, holy crap, I'm getting screwed over here with the fees. And then once you kind of make that connection, you're like, you know what? I'm going to jump to ETFs or something a little bit cheaper. Because I think I banked with Scotia. So I bought their equivalent to the TDE series and I was charging 1% for like a S&P 500 index fund. Buying something similar now with on Questrade, I'm paying 0.1% on the same exact.
Yeah, amount. So you're paying 10%. You're paying absolutely 10 times more with Scotia for that same product.
Absolutely, exactly the same product. Crazy.
Yeah.
So let's jump into now. Let's talk about just asset allocation in terms of how we're going to split up our money. And there are a lot of rules you can kind of look out there on Google. You know, there's the whole classic 120 minus your age, you know, your classic 60% stocks, 40% bonds. But because of COVID, it has really changed up the game. And I know a lot of people are really unsure with how to split up their cash now between stocks and bonds. And with inflation and with current interest rates, people are just really unsure with how to split their money. So in your opinion, how should teachers be rethinking their asset allocation? Or should they? Should they just currently just ride out the current environment and just stick with their plan? And how much of their cash should they be holding on to based off of the current environment that we're in?
Well, to start, Ronald, what I want to say is there is no current environment we're in. If you're young and you're new to investing, you'll think that whatever's happening right now is the worst thing that's ever happened on the planet or the most uncertain time ever. It's a heuristic bias. If you were 200-year-old, 300-year-old investor and you heard somebody say, well, it's just so uncertain right now, they would laugh at you. They would laugh at you because there has never been certainty. Ever. There wasn't certainty during World War I for sure, or during World War II, or when we had inflation in the late 70s and early 80s running 13% in Canada, and a mortgage rate in Canada, a five-year interest mortgage rate was peaking at 20%. Those were uncertain times. In the 1980s, I remember a poll being done at our school. So I graduated in 1988. So this poll was done, I think it was 1985. And we were asked whether we thought we would live to see our 50th birthdays. And the threat was nuclear war. It was the Cold War with the US and Russia. And it was something startling, like 71% of the people at our school actually believed that World War III would wipe us out before our 50th birthdays. These were uncertain times, Ronald. very uncertain times. We had my bank savings account in 1981 to 1982 paying me 10%. And bonds paid more than that. And I remember,
oh my God,
you know, if you look back now, and if I tell somebody young that, they say, wow, that's incredible. Your bank savings account paid you like 10% in 1981, 1982. And I'd say, yeah, it did. but the price of a chocolate bar that year rose more than 10%. So crazy. I lost to inflation. So as much as you might say, anyone can say, well, bond interest rates are so low right now, it's so relative. It's always relative to two things. What's inflation? And of course, inflation is low. If inflation were running at 10%, 12%, bond rates were, you know, 1%, I'd say, that's kind of scary. But inflation rates are also very low. Another factor is, as an investor, instead of thinking about today or this week or this month or 2 or 3 years from now, we have to think in terms of 30-year periods. Because even if you're 60 years old and you plan to live until hopefully you're 90, you have a 30-year investment duration. So I'll say that again. A 60-year-old has a 30-year investment duration. That's the only thing they should think about. It's not like they won't be spending some of their investments, because as retirees, they're going to be withdrawing a portion of their investment portfolio every single year to live on. But they're not going to pull out all of it. They'll pull out probably an inflation-adjusted 4% per year or something to that effect. So the vast majority of their money will be continuing to grow as they continue to pull an ever-increasing sum out to cover their cost of living with adjustments for inflation. So I really try to emphasize to people the two things. There are no certain times. There have never been certain times. So whatever's happening today, don't let a heuristic bias influence you to make you think that something's different now. You have to change something up. Bond interest rates are really low, but do you know what bond interest rates will be 5 years from now? If you have a bond market index, it rotates. It perpetually rotates. So when a bond expires, that bond index picks up another bond at whatever the going rate happens to be at that point in time. So it's a revolving door of indexes. Now, do you know, or does anyone know, what interest rates for bonds will be 5 years or 10 years from now or 3 years from now or even next month? Nobody knows. If you're listening to this right now and you think that you do know, go out and save somebody, because it tells me you can see the future and you can't, right? You should be a superhero. The economists can't predict this stuff either. So one of the fun things we do as journalists, and Larry Swedrow does an awesome job of this. He takes like the world's most esteemed economists every year, and they'll predict the price of oil and the price of gold and the price of the U.S., the level of the U.S. dollar, where the S&P 500 will go. And they'll predict it. People ask them to predict this stuff. They'll predict it. They're happy enough to get their name in the paper or to be on CNBC. And then he tracks it 12 months later and he makes them all look like asses. But people have such short memories, and we want to believe that there are people that can see the future. Warren Buffett says it best. He's like, look, stock market forecasters, they exist to make fortune tellers look good.
That is so true. I love that saying. Now, I have a feeling I know what the answer is going to be for my next question, but I'm going to have to ask anyways. I'm going to ask because there's a lot of people thinking this. Because the stock market is so overpriced right now, we see that with some of the statistics. If you take a look at PE ratios or Shiller PE ratios, the stock market is very frothy right now. And a lot of people are hesitant to start investing and putting their money into the stock market because they think, oh, I'm getting ripped off. Things are so expensive. Or they might hear things in the news, like you said, that there might be another stock market crash and people are predicting this. What do you think people should be doing then in terms of investing into the stock market? Should they be waiting for things to kind of cool off in this kind of environment? Or, you know what, there is no right time, to your point. You can't predict the future. So let's just go right in.
Literally, the best investors are those typically that have no idea what level the stock market is at. They've got a diversified portfolio. They just add to it every single month. And they end up, through dollar cost averaging, pay less than an average unit price. Once we start predicting, we start getting ourselves into trouble. So we talked about the level of the stock market. Well, okay, it was this level, this current level in 1996, the US market was. But for then 4 or 5 straight years, it went on to make double-digit gains. So if you're going to sit on the sidelines and it's 1996 again, you're going to miss out on really doubling your money. practically doubling your money between 1996 and say 2001. The other factor is this. I think if I were sitting in a bar with somebody and they were saying the stock market is so overinflated right now, to play a little bit of a devil's advocate, and not to be a jerk, but just to broaden the scope of things, I would ask, well, what stock market? The French stock market? Because no, it's not expensive. It's actually lower priced in terms of its price relative to business earnings than its historical average. Oh, the British stock market? No, that too is really, really cheap. The Russian stock market? I don't know if the Russian stock market's ever been cheaper, frankly. So here's the fascinating thing. If we look at the global stock market, and these people are going to be referring to something called a CAPE ratio. So it's cyclically adjusted business earnings over a 10-year period adjusted to inflation relative to price. It sounds really quite technical, but just think of it as like price tag for the stock market relative to earnings. It has to be relative to earnings, right? Relative to the corporations and what the corporations are making. So stocks don't necessarily get more expensive when they rise. They only get more expensive when they rise faster than the corporate earnings of the underlying businesses that the market is actually tracking. So if we take that and we look at the global stock market, and when I say that, I'm referring to the whole thing, the US market, the Russian, the Canadian, the Australian, the German, and we're bundle it all together and we were to do an assessment on how expensive it is, Ronald, it's at about the same level today that it was at in 1987. And so these things are really important. We get sound bites from the media, which can frighten us. And they're incomplete sound bites, right? They're sound bites that will grab your attention. They'll evoke fear, but they're not very academically broad. So if you have, and I love the all-in-one products, like the all-in-one ETF products. I think they're just amazing. So first of all, what are they? They're an ETF that you could buy. It's a single product. And within it, you'll have a broad Canadian bond market index or ETF. Within it, you'll have a US ETF. Within it, you'll have an international ETF. You'll also have an emerging market ETF. It's all wrapped up. You can, like, it's one of those Halloween grab bags. You know, like when you're a kid, you get this one pack and you get all these different kinds of like cool stuff in it. It's just like that. So it includes the entire market plus a bond element. And so let's just assume, for argument's sake, that you wanted to run away from US stocks, or you just didn't want a high component of US stocks because they're relatively expensive. First of all, that's a silly thing to do, is to run away from a big component of the stock market because you think it's going to drop. It's much, much better just to own everything and then just keep adding money as you have it. But let's assume somebody has like a portfolio of ETFs, and it's one of those all-in-one portfolios, and it has 60% stocks and 40% bonds. That's just as an example. That person's US stock market exposure is only going to be about 15% of their total overall portfolio. So the risk people get into is thinking too much. And I come back to that Fidelity study. I come back to the reality that your investment portfolio is like a bar of soap. The more you mess with it, the smaller it gets. And the less you think, about hot sectors, or less you think about market levels, less you think about market timing, statistically, the better you are going to be as an investor. Most super smart people won't beat my sister. She has no interest. But most super smart people will not beat her.
You know, it's funny that you say that, because I have a friend named Jake, and I hope he's going to be listening to this, because what you brought up is exactly describing what he's doing. He's a veterinarian, not really a lot of knowledge kind of in investing, but he's one of those guys that's smart enough to say, you know what, I'm just going to buy one of these all-in-one products. So he buys this one product from Vanguard, actually, called V-Ball. exactly what you described, 60% stocks, 40% bonds, and he just drips money into it every single month. And he's doing very, very well, probably doing a lot better than some perhaps professionals out there that are trying to time the market, whatnot. Yeah. And I always say to him in our little group chat, I'm like, you know, congratulations, man. Like you're doing the right thing. And sometimes investing doesn't have to be sexy, as long as you are just playing by just basic rules there. As I'm glad that you said that and you brought that up.
Jake
is a very smart guy. I'm going to have to force him to listen to this episode now.
Jake's performance will beat most college endowment funds, most hedge funds, most professionally managed money.
So Andrew, I'm actually taking a look at the time right now. And why don't we put a pin in our conversation? Because we got so much more stuff to talk about and we just don't have enough time this week. So why don't we put things on simmer? We come back next week and we're going to finish up our conversation on investing. So for all our listeners out there, if you really enjoyed this week's content, stay tuned because next week we're going to continue our conversation with Andrew. And we're going to talk about things like cash, bond allocation, cryptocurrency, real estate, and so much more. So guys, thank you so much again for tuning in this week, and we're going to see you guys next time. Woo!